Return on India is the latest release in the Colossus family of podcasts. For full transcripts and more supporting materials, make sure to check out joincolossus.com. There you will find the full library of content from Colossus shows like Invest Like the Best, Business Breakdowns, Web3 Breakdowns, Founders, 50X, and now Return on India. If you'd like to stay up to date on all announcements for Return on India and other Colossus shows, make sure to sign up for the weekly newsletter, again, on joincolossus.com. Now on to the show.
Welcome to Return on India, a deep dive series covering one of the most populous and promising economies in the world. Through conversations with central figures in Indian business, Return on India will unpack the details that matter for investors and operators. We will examine the unique cultural dynamics behind emerging demographic trends, and we will drill into key sectors by talking to the business leaders driving change. We plan to investigate the past, present, and future as we explore India's investment case. To find more episodes, transcripts, and a library of content to continue your learning, visit joincolossus.com. All opinions expressed by hosts and podcast guests are solely their own opinions. Hosts, podcast guests, their employers, or affiliates may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
My guest today is Nitin Kamath, founder and CEO of Zerodha. The last 10 years in the Indian startup ecosystem have been flush with venture capital, especially from the West. The country understandably has hit an inflection point, and capital allocators are bullish on the potential to build world-scale businesses in India today. One of the most fascinating businesses in India that's not as talked about and has taken no outside investor capital, though, is Zerodha, India's largest stockbroker. And the scale is staggering. Today, the company is 13 years old, has over 11 million users, and last year did over $250 million in profit. It's a story of building the business the right way and for the long term. I was thrilled to chat with Nitin today to explore the step function growth in the business, the market, and the country that enabled Zerodha's rapid ascent. Please enjoy my conversation with Nitin Kamath. Nitin, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Roman, for having me on this.
Yeah, Nitin, lots to talk about today. Excited to dive deep on a few topics. We'll obviously talk about Zerodha, fintech, and your perspectives on India. But I want to start with an overview of the business and just the state of the company today. As I had shared with you before, our audience is primarily in the West, and I'd love for you just to give context to how impressive of a business you and the team have built. It'd be great to give an overview of just what Zerodha is and the scale it's reached in India today.
Yeah, no, I mean, usually when someone's from the West, I say we are a Robin Hood version of Interactive Brokers, because our audience is a lot of first timers, but our bread butter is from very active traders. So the product we've built is a good mix of what active traders need, and also while keeping it very minimal for first-time investors to come through. We started the business in 2010 on top of a vendor product, and we were like the first brokers in India to introduce a flat fee per trade. You know, we started 20 bucks a trade, 20 rupees a trade, 30 cents a trade, or maybe now it's 25 cents. And we started the business focusing on very active day traders. Slowly, I think around 2013-14 is when we hit upon a point where we realized the active trading market is very shallow in the country. By then, the ambitions had grown, saying, you know, we need to build a more like a mass retail product. Kailash, who's our CTO, had joined us by then. So our product journey started with him from 2013 onwards. 2015 is when we launched our in-house products. And also 2015 is when we went zero brokerage for equity investing. We were charging for speculative trades, but we went zero broking for equity investing. I think this was around the same time Robinhood launched in the US as well, you know, when we went zero for equity broking. 2016 was really the tipping point in our journey. One, we had our own in-house products. We had this new pricing. And most importantly, we had this whole India stack moment, in the sense, in India, until 2016, to open an account, we had to get a user sign a 40-page document and courier it to us. So as you'd imagine, you know, not many were opening accounts. So in 2016, the entire thing went digital. So an account opening, which used to take like 40 pages and 2 weeks to open, became 15 minutes and no physical documents. So really, that's when we started kind of gaining ground on incumbents, because traditionally in India, brokers who had maximum physical presence. The more branches you had, more managers you had, the more accounts you opened. But then that moat got broken when this all went digital. So 2016 is when we started gaining traction, user growth. We were at around 60,000 customers, 65,000 customers in 2016. We are 11 million plus today. So it took us like 6 years to get to 60,000, and the rest happened in the last 6 years of sorts. And then, you know, the product kept evolving. We got extremely lucky in hindsight that we were not able to raise money early on in the journey. So we built the business bootstrapped. So in 2016, we also did another very accidentally, something that worked very well for the business, which was we opened a bunch of APIs and we invited startups to come build on top of us. So we called the initiative Rain Matter. So we also started investing in these startups. So we said we will build what is core competency to us, and all the adjacencies will partner with startups to do this. So there are, I think, almost like 15 or 16 startups who are part of this portfolio, building niche investing trading experiences on top of us. You know, think of us as, you know, Play Store. You know, think of us as Android and Rain Matter's Play Store of sorts. So the moat for us as a business was that we don't not only offer what is core to our business, but we also offer all these user experiences which isn't available with others out there. We run maybe the second or third largest education initiative on capital markets. It's called Varsity. Then we run the largest direct mutual fund platform in the country. And over the last 2 years since COVID, you know, I don't know what happened to the world, right? As in, it just, the business really took off. So the last financial year, we closed around 2,100 crores, let's say $250 million in profit approximately, you know. So, and I think, yeah, we'll probably end up doing 10-15% more this year. A lot of right place, right time. But the business has scaled up quite beautifully. And I think the main reason for this is underlying a lot of things fell into place, you know, be it the India, you know, Aadhaar for onboarding, or be it UPI for payments, be it the whole mobile penetration in the country, and generally the underlying bull market of sorts, right? As in, so all of them came together. So we're kind of at the right place, right time, with the right products and initiatives. So it's helped us quite a bit.
Yeah, double click into some of those factors, because in the original business plan, if I recall correctly, the best case outcome was 100,000 users. Today, as you said, you have 11 million. So obviously a step function off in a super positive way. What informed, when you guys did start, what informed that best case outcome of 100K users target? And then you mentioned some of the things that have happened in India that have enabled the 10 million plus users, but maybe you can double click a little bit more into what's gone on in mobile penetration, Aadhaar, so on and so forth.
Yeah. So I used to be a trader. I used to be a very active day trader, you know, like a retail trader. I used to trade for myself. I became, in India, you know, you have this concept of a sub broker. So, you know, you become a franchisee of a bigger broker and then set up a shop and do business, you know, very similar to how a McDonald's franchisee runs. So I was a franchise for a larger broker. My younger brother, Nikhil, had joined me, I think, in 2007. And he also was a trader. He's a much sharper trader than I am. So around 2009-10, you know, we kind of asked the question, why should two people sit and trade if one person is better? And I've generally been very active in the trading circuit of sorts. You know, I mean, I've run a bunch of communities online. I used to run some of the largest Yahoo Messenger groups on stock markets in India, you know, when Yahoo Messenger was in. And so I've always had this whole background of interacting with traders, etc. So the natural progression to that was really starting Zerodha. But when we started Zerodha, we had thought of only very active traders. There was no ambitions to kind of be what we are today. And the reason there was no ambition was because at that time, we didn't really have a technology solution. I mean, all we had was a vendor product. You know, it was like a bare bones platform. And so the bet was that, can you take this bare bones platform and reduce the pricing by going digital in terms of the way you operate? But the headline numbers in India, you know, are typically always very large, right? I mean, like everyone's looking at India as 1.5 billion. You know, like a lot of people think India is, because India is the largest derivative exchange in the world. So, you know, you automatically think that India probably has tens of millions of derivative traders. As in, but in reality, it's maybe 4 to 5 million, you know, who actively trade the markets. You know, I'm talking about day traders, derivative traders altogether. And this number was much smaller back in 2013-14. So by the time we started hitting 2013-14, you know, we kind of already started realizing that if we focused only on very active traders, we're going to hit a plateau very soon. The thing about active trading, is, especially when it comes to retail, is, you know, the mortality rates are quite high. As in, most people who trade the markets, try to trade the markets. So as soon as they don't make money, most of them drop off and they stop trading. So it's like being on a treadmill. So to be where you are, you need to keep constantly keep adding more customers. And by 2013-14, the ambitions also had grown because by then I checked upon our competition and kind of knew that the incumbents are slow and lazy. And today's world is about fast beating the slow and not big beating the small. You know, so by then I'd realized that it's possible to build a large business here. Yeah. So 2016, what happened really as in was that solving for that onboarding problem. See, the thing about a broking business is it's a business of money. In India, people don't trust brands very easily with their money. I think it's the same way across the world, but in India, it's much harder. You know, that's one of the reasons why State Bank of India is still the largest bank, or HDFC Bank is still the largest bank of India, because people don't just trust a brand with their funds and securities and our savings, etc. So for us, when this Aadhaar happened, we had built 6 years of some credibility of sorts. So it was the advantage we had on a lot of competition, which started around 2014-15-16, is that when Aadhaar happened, we had credibility, like a track record, where others were like 5-6 years too late. So by the time they could build that credibility, they had some catching up to do. So even today, if you look at us and you compare us to competition, there are two or three others who are very similar to us in terms of very close to us, 10, 15, 20% away in terms of user number wise. But in terms of AUM, in terms of revenues, in terms of, we are at least 6x of the nearest competition in the whole low cost online broking space. Firstly, the Aadhaar for onboarding, which was super important. When I say Aadhaar for onboarding, every Indian gets a Aadhaar card through which he can do a KYC and he can do a signature. A KYC is done using an OTP. So you enter an Aadhaar number, OTP from the government goes to the customer's mobile. He then uses that OTP to authorize to do a KYC. And then similarly, he can do a signature as well. And the second thing that happened in India was really around payments, because I think digital payments with UPI, especially, almost entire India has gone digital. I don't remember the last time I used cash, right? Because even the vegetable vendors on the streets have got UPI on them, you know, and paying everyone using UPI. So that was, we were like a really large beneficiary of India going digital in terms of its currency as well. And I think what happened in 2020 was there were a lot of fence sitters who were thinking of investing and trading. And then, you know, lockdown happened, the interest, I mean, it's very similar to what happened in the US, actually. The interest rates were low. All the other asset classes weren't doing that great. People stopped spending, so they had more money on their hand to look at stock markets. And then the first bunch of people who came invested in March, April of 2020, they saw money so quickly. And then that whole greed spread really fast. It just went quite viral that you can make money quickly in the markets, right? And you know, there is no bigger enabler than greed when it comes to the market. So it blew off. So India today has around 90 million Demat accounts. I mean, 90 million people who have a stock market account. We are a population of 1.5 billion. So a lot of people think India is an underpenetrated market. But in reality, in India, there were only, like, India's per capita is $2,000. If in India, only 50 million Indians filed an income tax return last year. So if a person is not filing an income tax return, he's unlikely to be saving, investing. So even assuming that there were three times the number of people who haven't filed the returns, who have enough money and savings to be able to invest in the markets, the target market size in reality is maybe 150 million and not really 1.5 billion, as a lot of people make it out to be. And if you look at 150 million and then look at 90 million who already have accounts, we are, I think, quite deeply penetrated of sorts. I think the real challenge for India is that we are a poor country and we need to find ways to get that per capita going up. How do you take it from 2,000 to 4,000, 5,000? Because that's when I think the next 200, 300 million Indians will really come into target audience of sorts. Because if people don't have the money, you know, how do you expect someone to save, invest? So yeah, so India broadly looks like really large in terms of numbers, but Indians who can generate revenue, Indians who can really purchase stuff online, I don't think is a really large market as such.
Yeah, I think that's one of the surprising things for investors, especially from the West, is India is kind of a Dalmau factory. Usage, especially for consumer companies, can look incredible. And in the West, people underwrite, especially early stage startups, on growth. The assumption, though, in the West is that that can translate into monetization, the unit economics turn correctly, which obviously we've seen a ton of companies in this last bull market cycle not ever be able to do that. But the assumption is the market is there. The challenge in India, as you pointed out, is that it's not guaranteed that that ARPU ever actually comes. The usage can be there, but that ARPU might not be there. When I was in India this past fall,
I was really amazed by, and I told folks in the West how amazed I was by the advancements in fintech specifically, right? Specifically UPI. You see the rickshawwalas and everybody on the street using UPI, those are a cash economy, which is an incredible advancement. I think one of the things that's less appreciated is not just the underlying technology, which is advanced, but some of the capital markets regulation, which has pretty interesting guardrails to prevent systemic risk. And you've pointed this out before. And so I want to go into a couple of the ones that I think really highlight the differences between the two countries' financial systems. I think it also highlights the cultural differences between the countries. So maybe first we can start, you've highlighted before some nuances and differences between, you know, how hedge funds and individuals can operate, how brokers can operate, the business model for exchanges. Maybe we can go into all three of those, but we can start first with short positions and explaining a little bit of the contours of short positions hedge funds and individuals can take in India versus in the US.
I think market infrastructure-wise, India is way ahead of the US, you know, in terms of, you know, I mean, there's no doubt about it. One of the reasons for that is that there is no lobbying in India. The broking industry is very new. India went online. So the National Stock Exchange started in 1994. So we are a very new capital market. The regulator is extremely powerful. There has been no broker lobby who has been able to fend off new regulations of sorts, you know. So I think that's the reason. So yeah, so how India works is when you open an account with a broker, you open what is called as a depository account, which is an account held with the two depositories in the country. And there is a trading account where you hold your funds and, you know, you use the funds to transact on the exchanges. Now, in the US, by default, most stockbrokers open what is called as a margin account. What it means is when the money is sitting with them and you buy some stocks, the stocks are lying in the margin account with the broker. What it means is the broker can potentially use that security for whatever purposes, right? As in India, it doesn't work like that. Once, you know, say if you open an account with us, you bought some stocks, it goes and sits in your DMAT account and it's completely ring fenced from the broker. You know, I can go bankrupt and nothing happens to that security. So there isn't like a margin account of sorts. And the other thing in India is that a broker can't act like a bank. So once in a quarter, we have to send back any unutilized funds back to the customer's bank account. So if you have done no transactions, actually once in 30 days. Now, if you're doing some transactions and once a quarter, we have to make your account zero, right? So now think about it, right? Like float income, especially with the interest rate cycles up in the US, you know, the float income for some of these brokers are just tremendous. And again, in the US, you know, you could use that float income for your working capital, which is your customer money, could be used for lending to others, etc. In India, it has to be kept. I can't use one customer's funds to lend to another customer, even if I wanted to. One is that. Now, the second thing in India is because there is no concept of margin accounts, if someone wants a short, you need to go to what is called as a stock lending and borrowing platform. And on the stock lending borrowing platform, you have to borrow it from another customer for a certain interest rate. So a broker can't do it on behalf of a customer. So for example, you want to short a stock X, you can come to the stock lending borrowing platform, you put a bid saying, I want to borrow this many stocks at this price. I can come and match it. Now, the stock lending and borrowing platform in India itself is very new and it's not very active. So most short trades really happen only in derivatives. So if someone's shorting, they're really shorting futures or using options for that. And because the stock lending and borrowing is not a very active platform is why India is also the largest derivative market in the world. Because anyone who wants to speculate, he has to really come to the derivatives market. And even within derivatives, the index derivatives are like 75-80% of the business. So the single stock derivatives is not really very popular of sorts. The other important thing is when you place an order on a platform, the order matching can happen only on the exchanges. So there is no concept of selling the order flow. I can't be a counter to my customer's order. The only thing I can do is when a customer places an order is take the order and send it to the exchanges. The customer even actually mentions which exchange. So India has two exchanges, National Stock Exchange and Bombay Stock Exchange. So a customer, while placing an order, decides where he wants to place and places an order. Also, the exchanges in India work in a very different kind of business model. Exchanges in India give data for free. So you don't have to, you know, kind of pay money for the data. So if you're a customer of a broker, the broker gives you data for free on the platform. And every customer gets the same data. So there is no, I'll pay more and I'll get some special type of data. So in a way, that's even playing field for everyone. And how exchanges make money in India is through transaction charges. So they charge a small cent for every trade. They still make a lot of money out of transaction fees. And I think it's a much cleaner model than where you charge differentially for data and then you create this uneven playing field of sorts. And I think, you know, payment for order flow, I don't even know. I mean, ethically also, I think it's just kind of, is very questionable. I don't know how it still is allowed in the US.
Well, the interesting thing is when you take kind of all of these in aggregate, the contours of shorting, how the brokers actually operate, the business models for exchanges, making transaction fees as opposed to payment for order flows, something interesting happens kind of systemically to the Indian market. So one of the observations of Indian markets today is they have relatively low levels of leverage in the ecosystem, which has actually become an advantage in global markets as you see the up and down volatility. Talk a little bit more just about the levels of leverage in the Indian ecosystem. That was something that was very interesting to me to learn about compared to other advanced economies.
So what happened in India was, you know, around 2015 and 16, one of the large brokers in India, you know, called Karvi, they cheated with customer funds. So they took customer funds and they tried to divert it to another business, lost money. And it was like a mega incident. And the regulator just made so many regulatory changes over the last 4 or 5 years. And the biggest change really was also to take away leverage completely. So in India today, the maximum leverage we can offer on an equity kind of a trade is like 5 times. And there is no leverage on derivatives. As in, you know, so we don't have the freedom. So even if I want to take the risk, I can't take risk beyond what is defined by the regulator. Even for example, you know, if you want to borrow against securities, the haircut today is 50%. One of the big problems in 2007-08 for India and across the globe was, you know, a lot of promoters borrowing against the stock. So in India, you know, after 2008, that whole crisis, the Reserve Bank of India came in and said that the maximum anyone can borrow against stock is 50%. So leverage in all ways has reduced significantly over the last few years. So what happened in the last 2 or 3 years, I've never seen this happen ever in my life, because I've been trading like for 20 plus years now. I've never seen India being lower volatile than the US. Usually it used to be, if US sneezes, we catch a cold. And this time around, it's actually been absolutely different. As in, you've got US markets down 4.5%, 5%. We wake up and we see our markets are moving in a 0.5% range. And it's just quite crazy to see something like that happen, because it's never really happened before. And I think the main reason for that is all the regulatory changes in terms of reducing leverage. Some of my customers definitely don't like me for saying this, but I've been a big proponent of this for a long time, because leverage is really what kills most retail traders. While it seems like you can make a lot of money with all these unlimited amounts of leverage, but in reality, it's almost impossible for most retail traders at least to be able to do it, because you're always one stupidity away from blowing up. And you know, that stupidity is usually, you can't get away from it. In a way, I think that low leverage has also increased the lifespan of traders. So it gives them more leeway to learn, trade, and experiment and get better. So even in terms of profitability, there's something that internally we have seen. Overall, our customers are more profitable from the time the leverages have reduced versus before, when we could give higher leverages.
If you take the flip side, what areas of the Indian ecosystem in your mind are underdeveloped compared to the US system?
So the big one in India, this whole financial education is really, really missing. We are never taught about finance in schools and colleges. It's not even part of the culture. The head of the family doesn't talk about finances to anyone in the family. It's usually the man in the house, and he doesn't even talk about it to the wife. As in, a lot of times, you know, we've had these cases where after the husband's dead, the wife reaches out and she has no clue, as in what has happened in the account, etc. So the financial education bit is really the problem. And also the second piece here is India has always been a distributor-led business versus an advisory-led business. The people who have sold the maximum financial products are your bank managers, your insurance distributors, your mutual fund distributors. All these guys are people who make money from the manufacturer and are not the ones who charge an advisory fees. So there's always been this whole conflict of interest, which is a bank manager has a conflict in you knowing too much about the product. So he's almost got an incentive to not tell you everything or confuse you. So what has happened in the US, which is very cool, has been always like a more advisory first business model. So where advisor has to justify the reason for paying the advisory fees. And the thing about the US is people pay that advisory fees, right? I mean, it's culturally, you're okay paying. In India, I could make like 10% selling a product from the manufacturer and the user will have no problem. But if I were to ask him 0.1% as an advisory fees, he will, you know, probably refuse to give me that advisory fees. You know, even if I'm telling you, I'm saving you 10% on it. Indians have been very reluctant in paying the advisory fees, which has also meant that for a population of 1.5 billion, we have 1,000 plus advisors, which is quite ridiculous of sorts. And when we look back at Zero, we started with this whole, we want to help traders do better. And then the journey kept changing over time. But eventually the question we've been asking internally is that the reason we exist as a business is to help our customers do better in terms of the money. Otherwise, there's no point in existing as a business. And I think the way to solve for the problem is to figure ways to build an advisory ecosystem where you can have an advisor who's got no conflict with the customer, educate the customer in terms of what are the right products, et cetera. And then that education propagates there. If we can go and teach 1,000 people why you do what you do for, and 1,000 in turn will propagate that to a lot more people. So advisory is a big, I think, the missing piece. And there is some, the excitement around solving for this problem is also because of the new, you know, stack of what the government has put up with account aggregator. Because in India, you've never had a service like Yodlee, et cetera. You know, in the sense, if you want to advise, you need the entire financial information of the customer, which means the customer has to willingly share like whatever his details are, you know, different trading accounts, different bank accounts, et cetera. So the new account aggregator service allows us to get entire financial information of a customer with a click of a button, with an OTP that goes to the customer. Customer authorizes, we get the information, and then you can use that information and maybe advise. And because you're getting all this information, you can potentially consume this using a program versus some human trying to do a guesswork of what the customer is saying is net worth. And in India, you know, people have this other problem that no one tells their actual income. Most of them, if it's for a loan, they might say the right thing. Anything apart from the loan, you know, everyone's understating how much they're worth or how much they earn. So if you have wrong information, you can anyways not give right advice. So now that we are getting this whole data coming in machine consumable kind of format, I think the opportunity right now in India is to build advisory businesses, which will also help the country as such.
You guys have built the largest stockbroker in India. I think it's interesting because typically when we talk about Indian companies, especially from the West, historically, it's been, what is the kind of X for Y model? So Ola was the Uber for India, et cetera. We talked a little bit earlier in the conversation about how the best analogy is probably Robinhood, although I would say, I think it's generous saying Zerodha is the Robinhood of India, because it really should be, Robinhood should aspire to be the Zerodha of the US. And I say that because you guys have built the business properly. There's underlying product decisions that I want to call out some examples of, because I think they're particularly interesting, both from a company building perspective, as well as a consumer psychology perspective. So some of the examples of decisions you guys have made in the product that are different, certainly from Western counterpart businesses, are things like no margin lending, even though that would increase your revenue by at least 1,000 crore, probably, maybe more. Nudges to prevent traders from trading more money to ensure they don't lose money. There was a tweet of a consumer that I was seeing that basically called out that Zerodha prevented me from making a bad decision. In the US, you have CNBC articles that talk about the trader in their basement that lost all their money. This is the total opposite. Despite having an NBFC license, not really a material lending portion of the business. I want you to unpack those product decisions, because I think it's interesting, again, as I mentioned earlier, to get the perspective both from two sides. One is the company building side. Those are all short-term revenue trade-offs. So why did you guys make those decisions? And then from a psychology of the Indian consumer perspective, I'm curious why you made those decisions.
I think we kind of, like I said earlier, we lucked out by not getting professional investors in the company, which meant that we could build the business the way we want. And in my head, you know, right from day one of the business, we're trying to solve for a certain problem of the customer. And it was never about building the business. No, business was really built accidentally. You know? So I don't think we have ever, as a business, sat and said, we need to grow X percentage this year, or we need to get to X revenue this year. We have never, ever, as a business, spoken. We have never had sales targets to anyone in the company. I know that if I put a sales target, someone's going to missell something to someone. There's no other way. Humans will take the easy way out. You can't stop that from happening. If you don't have a sales target, then people don't have an incentive to sell or upsell or whatever, right? And one of the reasons for our profitability is that we haven't spent a single rupee on marketing and advertisement till date. You know, not a single Google ad, not a single Facebook campaign or whatever. So all of them have come All the 11 million customers have come to us organically. And in India, the cost of acquisition, I think, for a broking firm is between $30 to $40. If we had spent whatever, you know, like 11 million into $40, we would have spent like $400-500 million just in terms of cost of acquisition, which would potentially be a lot of our net profits till date. Right at the start, I had the realization that the margins at which we work, we cannot go spend on user acquisition. Because in India, like I said earlier, right, as in there is no way to make money from float. There is no securities lending. There is no order flow income. The only way you can really make money is from a transaction fees. And if you spend $30 or $40 and you're charging 20 cents a trade or 30 cents a trade, it's very hard to generate money. The first decision was not to market and advertise, which meant that we had to do something else to acquire user. So in the first 3 or 4 years, it was mostly about transparency. I remember we were like the first brokers to put a blog, and we put up a Q&A forum. We are actively putting our head on the table and answering people's queries, which was kind of unheard of in financial services. You don't have a CEO of a company answering people's queries, which also helped significantly in terms of building credibility. Then Kailash joined. He's like my guru, like of sorts. I have something called as a K filter in my life. So he joined, and a lot of his philosophies kind of started rubbing off on me and in turn the business, which is, I came from the school of thought that throwing people at problems can solve the problem. And he kind of brought in this whole theory saying, you know, people complicate problems. So having more people necessarily doesn't mean life gets better. It actually potentially could mean life gets worse. So some of that started happening. We had to rely completely on word of mouth to grow because we're not spending. But we knew that word of mouth would stop kicking in as soon as you do something which is not right for the customer. What is not right for the customer is something as simple as sending a stock tip, which doesn't make money. So we've never till date sent a customer a stock tip, even though I know that if I send a stock tip, it'll lead to transaction, it'll lead to revenue. We, on the other side, right, we actively dissuade customer from trading. So if you're trading penny stocks on Zerodha, you know, we almost scare the shit out of the customer saying, what are you doing? You know, like, what are you smoking? Why do you want to even trade? So all of this, our journey and compare it to a lot of our competitors, I think the wiring is of 10 years. And most of our competitors think 3 months to 1 year. So as soon as you start optimizing what is right for the short term, you just generally have to compromise a lot in terms of what happens to the user. We have that education initiative called Varsity, which is probably the largest in the country. So we have a few million users who have registered on Varsity. Not once have we sent them an email saying, open an account at Zerodha. Not once have we put an advertisement or a banner on Varsity saying, open an account with Zerodha. Because the intention is to educate the customer. So we want to do that. Now, in hindsight, what I realized was our thought like this itself is a moat. A lot of people question saying, why is this person teaching me all of this, answering my queries without even any expectation? That itself helps you build credibility of sorts. It's kind of helped us stand out. But if you kind of boil it down, two things. One, we always are thinking long-term. And if you think 10 years out and you realize that you don't want customers to borrow, you don't want customers to leverage, you don't want customers to do too many trades, you want your customer to trade as long as possible. Because if he's trading as long as possible, he's going to be word of mouth for you. If he's word of mouth, you reduce your CAC, or you can continue doing the business at no CAC. And also, you know, if you can build a brand like this, you can then potentially do other things in life, which people associate with as well. As in, it's very counterintuitive to what's happening in the world. But one of the reasons we come out and talk about this actively is that just to say that it is possible to still build a large business with this school of thought. I'm not saying the other school of thought is wrong, but this is also possible. And personally, what I've realized is this is a lot more fulfilling than, you know, getting up every day chasing something which you can never reach of sorts. Because, you know, these goals that you set, the goalposts keep extending every time you get close to it, right? As in, so there is, you know, it's a constant chase, which has also meant that we've been able to retain customers, retain employees. Our team attrition is hardly anything. We have 35 people on our tech team, and they've stuck around the whole course, you know, in the sense. And the way money compounds with time, people's skill sets also compound with time. And if you can have people stick around with you long enough, the contribution they bring on the table just goes up exponentially, right? One good person is equal to 100 average people who don't get the context of business. And so one person who spent 5 years has grown intellectually, professionally, etc., is more valuable than 500 freshers that you can hire. All of these, the joke at Zerodha is that, you know, we fight every time we have a push notification to be sent. In the last 1 year, we have sent 12 push notifications on the mobile app. And I think our competitors do 12 a week. But every time we have to send one push notification, we have a debate saying, should we send it or not send it? So at the end of it, you know, I think the way we are thinking is that we don't want anything to do to our customer that we would not like it ourselves. I also understand while this sounds very Guruji doc types, but in reality, this also helps us stand out. This itself is a moat. Sorry, long answer.
No, it's particularly interesting because if you pair kind of the key theme from what you're saying, what I hear very clearly is one of sustainability and endurance. And I think as capital markets have turned, that concept of sustainability, endurance, resilience in business models has come in vogue. Maybe it should have always been in vogue, but it's kind of come back in vogue. One of the interesting decision points I want to get your thoughts on are, how did you guys, when the flood of Western venture capital came in, into India, right, over the last, call it 5-6 years. How did that affect your business? And how did that keep your conviction that we're still not going to raise outside capital? I think you've said before that building Zerodha today as a bootstrap business would not be possible. When you're operating in a market, there's one notion of how you want to run the business and operate the business. And then there's another notion of how do you have to react outside into what's actually going on in the market ecosystem. I imagine there were tons of bottoms-up fintech competitors that were coming that were going the venture capital route and had upside-down CACs and were putting pressure kind of in the industry, right? And so you guys have continued to sustain meteoric growth levels without falling susceptible to that. How were you able to do that?
The moat was really everything that I said before. I kind of knew that as soon as a competition raises money, they'll not be able to say and do everything that I just said. And if you raise so much money, can you stop yourself from sending 12 push notifications a week? Now you have pressure. Once you've taken the money, you have obligation to grow the business fast. Every time one of our competitors took money at really high, ridiculous valuation, I knew that the product's going to deteriorate. I mean, the offering can't get better just because it's taken more money. So that has been the core philosophy, which is saying that we need to stick to our moat, which is to do what is right for the user. While every business says that I'll do what is right for the user, very few people kind of walk the talk. And us having done that has helped us build a brand today, which people care for. And other thing which has helped us by not raising money is a lot of people look at us still as an underdog. Now, we started with an allocation of like $150 million to what we call as Rain Matter Foundation. And we talk about it actively. And I know that, you know, it's very hard for a competition to do that unless you can't be taking venture money and then putting it for causes which are for the good of the society. So while we're doing it because it's right for the society, but I also understand that it'll also help us stand out as a business. I think for us personally also, you know, like the core team, our lifestyles stopped catching up with the net worth from 2016-17 onwards. The other, you go from economy to business to first class to private, and there's no end to that, right? And then, you know, you're constantly wanting more money, and then, you know, you're chasing valuations and exits and stuff like that. I just kind of live in the same house I'm living, you know, for like, you know, like last 6 or 7 years. So nothing personally has, of course, you know, I might have bought a better car, but it's nothing, you know, it's like probably 0.01% of what the net worth changed over that time. So a lot of people, you know, like the biggest VCs and PEs in the world came and offered us almost blank checks. I remember one guy who said, you know, why don't you, I said, we don't need money for the business because the business doesn't need it. And he said, why don't you go buy yourself a plane with this? But that never excited us. Today, I think the best part about our business is really the freedom to do what is right for the customer. And to be able to do it at this scale is really, I think, the big moat for the business.
One of the phenomena that's ringing, I think, truer by the day is this concept that the most valuable companies in India are going to be built natively within India. There's another parallel idea that I think also rings true by the day, which is Indian companies can be built from India for the world. I'm curious how you think about operating outside of India, whether or not it's on the Zerodha roadmap ever, but I'm curious how you think about that and if the same cultural principles we've talked about, a lot of the underlying concepts we've talked about today ultimately come back to being rooted in just Indian cultural philosophy as opposed to Western philosophy, endurance, resilience, long-term thinking, et cetera. I'm curious if you think those same cultural principles apply when thinking about customers and other end markets.
In 2019, I spent some time in New York. 2019 was a flat year for the business. And I was like, maybe we should take some of what we built, and what better country than the US? I spent like 2 or 3 months. And we were trying to acquire Introducing Broker, And 1 month into it, I knew it's not going to happen. You know, it just culturally was misfit. I don't think I would have survived the US. Just to be able to figure out the data vending regulation, the number of lawyers, the number of people I had to talk to and still not have clarity at the end of it. And the risk of violating some regulation is so high. So in India, I think we're blessed that regulations are explicit. There is no interpretation, which is brilliant, especially like a bootstrap business. You don't want to be taking unlimited amounts of risk. Forget the money loss, right? I mean, it's you, your head is on the table as well. One was that. And second, also, we realized that there is nothing that can be replicated. We had to essentially build everything grounds up. I think that way, you know, Interactive Brokers has just done a phenomenal job building like a platform that connects to so many different markets. Because I went and spent some time in smaller South Asian countries. Every country, the capital market infrastructure is almost different. Technologically as well, we realize that whatever we have spent time and effort on, you know, it is not going to be much use. Even something as simple as our education initiative, right? As in, it's so built for India context. So I was like, okay, can we just take that and make it US context? You know, can we change Reliance to Apple? Does it work? It doesn't, you know, because everything had to be redone, you know. So I don't think it's really possible for us, like the way we think and the way we work, to be able to kind of go operate, especially in a market like the US where the risks are too high, the regulations are gray. So it's very hard to build, I think, like a bootstrap business in this space in the US. I mean, even in India, like I said, starting today is really hard. The entry barriers are so high that you will be forced to go and raise capital. If I had to start Zerodha in 2023, I mean, it's impossible for me to do it.
We've talked a lot about financial services today. I want to round out the discussion with your thoughts on income distribution in the country. I think it relates obviously to the type of business you guys are building, but it's a lever to a bigger problem and bigger challenge. It's a lever to unpacking development and sustainability issues in India. You have this really interesting way of thinking about it, which I want to surface, which is India is 30,000 clusters of 20 villages each. Unpack that framework a little bit and just explain how that ties out to the advancement of India as a society.
So the thing is, 70% of India lives in rural India. India is not Bombay and Mumbai, Bangalore, right? As in India is smaller villages and etc. Now, like I said earlier, the big problem for India is our per capita GDP, which is we are at $2,000. And it's impossible for businesses to do well at scale if the per capita is just $2,000. I think the way to get it up is really to go and get the broader market, increase their financial health of sorts. So in 2017-18, when we started, the business started generating more cash than what it needs, is when Kailash and Nikhil, you know, we all started questioning, what do we do about this success? The money brings an obligation. I don't know if everyone thinks like that, but at least, you know, the core team, we have always thought that success brings an obligation of doing, of that success being used in some way for the betterment of the society. So that's how we started a foundation, the Rain Matter Foundation in 2020. And Sameer, who heads the foundation, he's the one, you know, who's brought this whole framework here. So the thing is, you want the poor India to start making more money. And the way we are thinking, India is 6 lakh villages, 600,000 villages. So if you thought of 30,000 clusters, or, you know, if you thought each cluster had 20 villages and each cluster was a business in itself, the idea is to figure out how do you make that business sustainable. Today, what happens is each of this cluster, the revenue that goes out of the cluster is so much more than the revenue generated within the cluster. And so that's why the cluster itself is unviable. And if you make that cluster sustainable, it'll also in turn help with the carbon footprint of the cluster, you know, so because most carbon footprint is caused by food transportation, by just moving of logistics, services, etc. So it's a really large problem, and I don't think we can solve it on our own. But what we are trying to do now is to at least put this out there as a foundation, saying we need to make these clusters viable. And one of the positive effects of this is, of course, you know, it can help India become inclusively wealthier, and it can also solve for the climate change issues that we're facing. If you actually go back in time, this Mahatma Gandhi wanted this, right? As in, Mahatma Gandhi was the biggest proponent of saying that, you know, these villages have to be, you know, self-sustaining economies. And I think it's needed today more than ever, because Indian cities are choking. There are no jobs in rural India. There's only so much you can keep doling out as incentives to rural India, right? So, I mean, you need the rural India to become economically viable. Otherwise, this per capita of $2,000 going to $4,000 or $5,000 will be really, really hard.
And then the final question I ask everybody that comes on the show is, if we were to look out over the next 10 years and India was to reach its potential, when we talk about India today, we talk a lot about India being at an inflection point and turning potential energy into kinetic energy. So if India was to reach its potential, in your mind, what would have gone right? And if in 10 years we look back and India has not reached its potential or did not come up to what we thought it would be, what would have gone wrong?
Yeah. I think gone wrong for sure is that, you know, if we don't do enough to kind of move the needle for the bottom half of the country, it's today the focus always, you know, in terms of every product, service, et cetera, being built out there is really for the top 5-10% of the country. And you know, that's not going to create large enough delta for the rest of the country. You need more to happen there. So if we haven't really gotten to where India should in 10 years, I think that would mean that the country has not done enough to help the rural India to step up. But I think we are beyond the inflection point. If you see what has happened over the last 2-3 years, now the question is, will this trend continue or not? If I were to talk about our industry, which I track closely, we're kind of hitting a plateau in terms of target market. The reason is that there are only so many Indians who have enough money to be able to invest, save, etc. I think a lot of digital players in India are hitting that plateau as well in terms of the audience who can generate revenue on online platforms. So that number is maybe, you know, in between 10 to 20 million, or so 100 to 200 million. Yeah, so we need to see if that trend continues. But the inflection point was 2020 for sure. The way all digital businesses in India grew was just phenomenal.
Nathan, this is awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on. Zerodha, I think, is a story for the world. It's not just a story of an Indian successful business. And so I really appreciate you taking the time and coming and sharing your perspectives.
Thanks. Thanks, Roman, for having me on this.
To keep learning about the topics discussed, head to joincolossus.com, where you'll find our curated list of resources, a transcript for this episode, and a library of conversations on investing and business. That's joincolossus.com.